Okay, some of you may be familiar with the theme of tonight's discussion, and some of you may not be. I do know that there was a smile that came on people's faces when they walked in and saw it, so I think at least we'll have an interesting discussion that will be enjoyable this evening. And my intent was initially in this presentation to have handout for you, but I wanted to put this up because I had some pictures. I want you to know that some things happened today that limited my ability to do everything I wanted to do. So I don't have a handout for you. There's not as many pictures as I intended. And it may be something that will spread out over a couple of weeks, but we may finish it tonight. It just depends on how quickly we go in our discussion. But one of the questions that comes up, because dinosaurs are so popular today, is what about the Bible and dinosaurs? How do Christians, especially those who would take the position that the earth is relatively young, how would we deal with the existence of dinosaurs and, of course, the tremendous years that evolutionists postulate with regard to their existence? The T-Rex right there is believed to have lived. Let me say this. A particular specimen of T-Rex that we're going to be talking about is believed to have lived 98 million years ago. And actually, I think T-Rex is one of the more recent of the dinosaurs. But regardless, and again, this is in the evolutionary hypothesis, regardless of that, it doesn't jibe with our view of the 6 days of creation and the relatively young Earth and existence and the relatively young universe as it exists. So we're going to have to try to explain that. Now, we're not going to agree with what the evolutionists teach on the matter, but there are some things that we, I think, can talk about that might be helpful. If you want to talk to someone about this, or perhaps if this has in some way tested your faith in the past. So that's the intent, and hopefully it will be something that will be beneficial to all of us. Again, I approach this from a layman perspective. I've done a lot of study on it. I've examined the Bible and what it teaches on the subject, and also what some young earth creationists say that have a scientific background, and we'll talk about some of those things. Just one little thing that I thought was kind of interesting. I remember talking with a couple of older preachers who were actually a bit upset with the young preacher because all he ever preached were topical lessons. And this one older preacher especially was he was adamant that there needs to be expository preaching. And they had gone and listened to the man preach, and the lesson title was Everything the Bible Says About Dinosaurs. And so the two older preachers, they weren't too happy with that topic because the Bible doesn't say anything about dinosaurs. And that was their estimation. And in fact, in a way, that's so. But there may be some indications of such creatures found in Scripture that we're going to look at as we get into the book of Job, for example. I know that many of you are familiar with that. But that's kind of what we're going to be talking about in our lesson this evening. Okay, the first point that we want to make is that the evolutionary date construct is something that is not in any way reconcilable with what the Bible teaches with regard to creation. You just can't do it. And we've actually touched on this a little bit, but we haven't taken the time really to deal with the disparity between the concept of 13 plus billion years in the existence of the universe, 4.5 billion years with regard to 6 billion years with regard to the existence of the earth, and we're talking about million plus years with regard to the existence of man on the earth, and what the Bible teaches concerning the 6 days of creation. We'll probably talk about dating and some of the problems with the suppositions and hypotheses that evolution has come up with at a future time. So we're going to only deal with that tangentially in our lesson this evening. But we do want to just spend a little bit of time, and again, maybe this will be helpful with regard to young people and children. But I want to start off by just noting what the word dinosaur means and where it comes from. And it comes from Greek. and the Greek word deinos, which means terrible, and sauros, lizard. And you've heard that before. Dinosaur means terrible lizard. And it actually is a made-up or coined term. It was made by Richard Owen, very top button there, or a bullet. Richard Owen coined the term in 1842. He found these bones, he coined them dinosaur or terrible lizard. So it was in the mid-19th century. Now, understand this. If it's the mid-19th century that the name is invented, the name dinosaur is coined, and the King James Version of the Bible was translated in the early 1600s, well, 240 years passed from the time in which the translation was in existence until the term was made up or coined. So what that means is, if there are creatures that are referred to in the Bible that we might say, well, this seems to be a dinosaur, well, it's not going to say dinosaur in the King James Version. I suppose that someone might have the audacity in some future time to, instead of putting behemoth in Job 40, they might say brontosaurus, although that's not the correct term anymore either. It's actually a different term. But they might put that in instead. But again, that's neither here nor there. The term didn't exist when the English translations were first translated. So, of course, when we say, is the Bible say anything about dinosaurs, we're not going to be able to go to some passage of Scripture and say, okay, here's the word dinosaur. The Bible's talking about dinosaurs in these places. Now, when the evolutionist talks about dinosaurs, what you need to remember is it's a fossil reptile. That's the classification of dinosaurs. They are reptiles, in contrast to mammals, contrast with birds. Now, I do recognize that that the supposition is out there now, of fairly recent origin, that the dinosaurs may have come or evolved from birds. That's a contention that some make. In fact, some people claim that it's possible that the dinosaurs actually had feathers, or at least some of them did. But anyway, it is a fossil reptile. So we have reptiles today. Understand that. We do have reptiles today. These are fossil reptiles that they place in a particular era and periods within that era, the Mesozoic era. And, of course, what we know about the reptiles, and I thought this was interesting with regard to this specific definition that I got, I think it may have been Merriam-Webster, but it was off the internet, is that it often reaching an enormous size. In reality, very few dinosaurs are large. And in fact, none of them come close to the largest animal that exists in the world today, which is, of course, the blue whale, which is a mammal. So mammals got bigger than dinosaurs. But as we know, the T-Rex that we had up at the beginning and some of these other dinosaurs are very large animals that existed. And the claim is that they existed in the Mesozoic era. I should have taken the time to give you the claimed parameters of the time of the Mesozoic era. But anyway, it's a long, long time ago according to evolutionary hypotheses. So that's the definition of the term. That's what we're referring to. Now, the question, why are dinosaurs not mentioned in the Bible, as we alluded to, is because the name wasn't mentioned until 1842. But they are reptiles, and there are some relatively large reptiles that continue to exist on the earth. I'm not saying they're nearly as big, unless you go to the movies and I think there was a movie called Lake Placid where there was a gigantic crocodile or alligator or something that was in the lake. You have to go to the Sci-Fi Channel with the B Sci-Fis in order to come across really, really big reptiles today. Or go watch the latest Godzilla movie in order to get that. But anyway, we do have what we might refer to as living dinosaurs in the sense of terrible lizards, large reptiles that exist today. And alligators and crocodiles are examples of this. There are a couple of passages that I wanted to make note of in Job, but I would like you to note that when we're talking about the idea of reptiles, that there is, I think, an allusion to them found in Genesis 1 and 26. You remember concerning the ultimate ascendancy and preeminence of man on the earth, and he having authority over all of the beasts of the field, the creeping things that creep upon the earth. That phrase creeping thing is something that is commonly used to refer to, and you can look at this throughout Scripture. A number of times that phrase is used, and most commonly having reference to reptiles, lizards, snakes, things like that. So there's that phrase that is used in Genesis 1:26. In Leviticus 11, there is a reference to a lizard and a tortoise. In Job 26 and verse 13, the serpent, and of course there are a number of other places, many places in which the term serpent is used. In Genesis account, Satan having the form of a serpent from the very beginning. And then it's an interesting reference in Isaiah 59 and verse 5 to what is referred to as a basilisk, some of you may want to turn to Isaiah 59 5. There's another term, it starts with a C, and I forget now what it was. Anyone have that? I'm sorry.
Cockatrice.
You look up basilisk or cockatrice in a dictionary, and it says a mythical creature or a legendary creature that had the body of a snake and the head of a rooster, and that with a single look could kill a man. So that's the legend. Now, that's not the biblical definition of a cockatrice or a basilisk, but and I don't know exactly what was referred to in Isaiah with reference to that, what animal was being referred to, but it was obviously something that was serpentine, something that was reptilian. So there are a number of examples in Scripture of reptiles. Of course, we also note that the term dragon is used, though I think metaphorically, in the book of Revelation as an example, and there are a couple of other places where that term is used. Again, when we talk about dragons, and I want to make a reference to dragons in a few moments with regard to the legends, understand that just because we have these legendary views of what dragons are, ability to fly through the air, ability to breathe fire, those kinds of things, that doesn't necessarily mean that there was not some creature upon which they were based. In other words, legends, they have that tendency to exaggerate. But the question is, when you have a ubiquitous dragon legend throughout various cultures in antiquity, what is that based upon? Is there any truth to it at all? And that's kind of an interesting question to raise. But the two that I want to make note of are two that that God describes to Job as a means of establishing his superior his power, his omnipotence, omniscience with regard to him creating these great creatures. And the description that is given of these individuals, it is explained away from time to time by people that, you know, the book of Job is one of the most ancient of books written. It's believed that it may have been the very first book written, or if not, then shortly after the writing of Moses in the Pentateuch, that this is a very, very old book. And there's a reference to these particular animals. And again, the description's given. See if you can think of any creature that exists upon the face of the earth today that can be described in this way. So starting with the behemoth in Job, the 40th chapter in verse 15. He says, "Look now at the behemoth." The definition, if you have that's given of that animal, it's a large animal, exact identity unknown, is what is given in the center reference in my Bible. He said, "I made along with you. He eats grass like an ox." So it's a vegetarian. "See now, his strength is in his hips and his power in his stomach muscles. He moves his tail like a cedar. The sinews of his thighs are tightly knit. His bones are like beams of bronze. His ribs are like bars of iron. He is the first of the ways of God. Only he who made him can bring it near his sword. Surely the mountains yield food for him, and all the beasts of the field play there. He lies under the lotus trees in a covert of reeds and marsh. The lotus trees cover him with their shade. The willows by the brook surround him. Indeed, the river may rage, yet he is not disturbed. He is confident, though the Jordan gushes into his mouth, though he takes it in his eyes, or one pierces his nose with a snare." A very powerful animal, a very large animal. It is stated there that he is first of the ways of God, verse 19 of the text. He is first of the ways of God. Anyone want to postulate if you were to consider a... What's the biggest land animal we can think of? Elephant? You may think of being bigger than an elephant? Maybe a hippopotamus as far as mass as being something similar to that. So that is basically what all he's talking about is an elephant. I'm talking about that. The description, however, does not fully explain that. And of course, the one that we make reference to is in verse 17, indicating a substantial tail, which is something that is different from what either an elephant or a hippo would have, which have very small tails in comparison to the rest of their body. So this is just an example of some kind of an unidentified animal that if you were to say, okay, what dinosaur, if we're going to say a dinosaur, what dinosaur does this most obviously describe? It'd be something like a brontosaurus, something with the grazes, and it has big legs and big ribs and a big tail and mighty, so much as it says only he who made him can bring near his sword. In other words, man would be impotent against him, but that only God would be able to withstand him. So that's the description that is given of Behemoth there in Job 40, 15 through 24. Now the next one is the Leviathan, which is a sea creature. If you look at, again, the center reference and the 41st chapter with regard to the Leviathan, it is a large sea creature, exact identity unknown. They really aren't trying to nail that down very good in the New King James translator's notes. But notice this. Can you draw out Leviathan with a hook or snare his tongue with a line which you lower? So he's not talking about a fish that you can catch with a rod and reel. Can you put a reed through his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook? Will he make many supplications to you? Will he speak softly to you? Will he make a covenant with you? Will you take him as a servant forever? Will you play with him as with a bird? Or will you leash him for your maidens? Will your companions make a banquet of him? Will they apportion him among the merchants? Can you fill his skin with harpoons? Now here's again a part of the description that indicates something with regard to the hide. Can you fill his skin with harpoons or his head with fishing spears? Lay your hand on him. Remember the battle. Never do it again. Don't mess with the Leviathan. Indeed, any hope of overcoming him is false. Shall one not be overwhelmed at the sight of him? No one is so fierce that he would dare stir him up. Who then is able to stand against me? Who has preceded me that I should pay him? Everything under heaven is mine. Again, that's an indication that he who has created this great beast is the omnipotent God of heaven. He said, I will not conceal his limbs, his mighty power, or his graceful proportions. Who can remove his outer coat? Who can approach him with a double bridle? Who can open the doors of his face with his terrible teeth all around? His rows of scales are his pride. So now we've got scales and we have terrible teeth. His row of scales are his pride, shut up tightly as with a seal. One is so near another that no air can come between them. They're joined to one another. They stick together and cannot be parted. His sneezings flash forth light, and his eyes are like the eyelids of the morning. Out of his mouth go burning lights. Sparks of fire shoot out, and smoke goes out of his nostrils as from a boiling pot and burning rushes. We don't know what that means. Everything else is a pretty clear and, I think, factual description, so I suppose that this is the case as well. Perhaps a portion of the legends concerning dragons come from a remembrance of this particular description given of the Leviathan. But the folds of his flesh, verse 23, are joined together, are firm on him, and cannot be moved. His heart is as hard as stone, even as hard as the lower millstone. When he raises himself up, the mighty are afraid because of his crashings. They are beside themselves. Though the sword reaches him, it cannot avail, nor does spear, dart, or javelin. He regards iron as straw, and bronze as rotten wood. The arrow cannot make him flee. Sling stones become like stubble to him. Darts are regarded as straw. He laughs at the threat of javelins. His undersides are like sharp sharp potsherds. He spreads pointed marks in the mire. He makes the deep boil like a pot. He makes the sea like a pot of ointment. He leaves a shining wake behind him, and one would think the deep had white hair. On earth, there is nothing like him, which is made without fear. He beholds every high thing. He is king over all the children of pride. So again, it is a great sea creature of unknown origin, exact identity unknown. But again, it would be very difficult to describe this creature, and looking at any known fish of the sea. The only one I can think of as closest would be, as far as what it sounds like, would be a gar. You know, they got scales and they got teeth. With regard to size and fierceness, maybe a great white shark. But even those, they don't describe what we're seeing here. And of course, nothing that we know of is one that would be described with regard to the language of verses 18 and following concerning the smoke and the breath. So,
a lot of this would apply to an alligator.
Yeah, alligator being
a lot of it.
Yeah, possibly, because the alligator would be in from the water. And be saltwater crocodile.
The scales and the mouth, yeah. The teeth, and the mouth kind of open them.
I was thinking fish lights, but yeah, alligator would work. But again, what we find here are some descriptions. So the point being this: if we take the position that the earth is young, then there are a couple of things that come as a result of this. There are consequences for you we would take. Number one is that since there are 6 days between the creation of the earth and the creation of man, it's all accomplished in a 6-day period, that man must have coexisted with the dinosaurs. And that the dinosaurs cannot be separated from man by millions and millions and millions of years, so they're relatively recent origins. So it would not surprise us, then, if we go to the book, the Bible, and begin to look for some description, that there might be a description of those things that we have uncovered in the ground. Of course, excavation uncovered those fossils. I'm sure that there were some that existed prior to 1850, but, you know, wow, this is big. What is this? Let's call it a terrible lizard. You know, that kind of thing began, and that was the beginnings of modern-day excavation of reptile fossils. So it would surprise us if there were not some descriptions or some evidence that we could look to that that would say, okay, maybe that's what they're referring to, using different words, of course. But the point being that perhaps there are references of some type to large reptiles, which is all that we can go by. We don't accept the concept that they occurred in the Mesozoic era and was extinct 100 million years before man came on the picture, came into the picture. So these descriptions may be in part those things. Now, how are we going to explain the fact they're not here today? And of course, I've talked with some creationists who have that scientific background. They say, well, some of them are, just none of the big ones. But some of them are here today. And of course, if you talk about, let's say an alligator or a crocodile is not extinct, you should look this up and then think to, when did crocodiles come on the scene? Well, they're ancient too. They've been around for a long, long time. I don't know how long, but they've been around for a long, long time. So there are some that still exist to this day. Okay? But keeping that in mind, by the way, anybody have any questions about any of this? Yes, Tom?
Just this morning on the radio, you're talking about extinction. They mentioned a fact, or did you know was the cat, right? And that it was either 90 or 99% of all animals are extinct today.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Extinctions are very common. But it is kind of interesting. There's a fish, and I'm not going to pronounce it correct. I may not even spell it correctly, but the coelacanth?
Coelacanth.
Thank you. See, I know I wouldn't pronounce it correctly. Coelacanth is a fish that that was supposedly an ancient fish, and we're talking about millions and millions of years, been extinct for millions and millions of years, and they found one. Actually, they found a number of them now. So it's not extinct at all, although it had been thought to be extinct, and they would go and find fossils of it and say this was, this lived hundreds of millions of years ago, and they're not, it died out hundreds of millions of years ago, and they're not in it. Well, there are. That's just kind of an interesting thing, but just to indicate, and it, by the way, it's unchanged. You know, there are no major changes from the fossils to the living specimens that they have today.
Well, when you read Joel, man must have been at the same time, because they talk about the spear and the javelin and all. These are instruments that man made.
And I do want to emphasize something. I cannot dogmatically state these are dinosaurs we're talking about. There's just no way that we can. And I'm not going to say that, what does the Bible say about dinosaurs? Well, go to Job or go, these verses, that those are direct references. Other than, I think, Genesis 1:26 and the references to the creeping things that God created in the beginning. But it may be. That's all I'm going. I'm going to give you some things that I think are interesting to look at as we go on. But that's as far as I'm willing to go, because I think that the new King James translators are right in saying that these are of unknown origin. It's simply that the description does not correctly fit any creature that we see on earth today. It certainly doesn't. Okay, the next point I want to make is that there is a term that is used in the Hebrew. It's found, I think, 28 times in the King James Version that is described. But the word, the Hebrew Tanyan, it occurs 28 times in the Hebrew Scriptures, and the King James translates it in the following manner. Call it a dragon 21 times, serpent 3 times, whale 3 times, and sea monster once. And you can go and look that up with your own time. So this is a term. Again, so you want a term, dinosaur, here's a term that may be the closest that we have to that, found in the Hebrew language having reference. And again, the inconsistency with regard to the translation is indicative, not so much that the Hebrew translators or the English translators didn't know what to do with it, but that the context would demand a different thing, because this term was used with regard to snakes as well as dragons in regard to the creatures. And so it's hard to know exactly what it is. The context would determine what the translation should be at any particular time. But you can take the time to look up that word and look at the usage of it if you'd like to on your own. So while we can't know for sure what the animals were, in Job 40:41 at least, they most closely approximate what we know of dinosaurs from the fossils that have been uncovered. And that's just kind of the point that I wanted to make. That's the beginning part. I spent a little bit more time than I probably should have on it, but I did want to read those because they're very beneficial. Okay, now what I want to do is to give a hypothesis as to what might have happened to the dinosaurs. And this is, again, we don't know. Just like the evolutionists don't know, I was reading an article just today in preparation for this as to the claim that an asteroid came and hit the Earth and the extinction of the dinosaurs was because of an asteroid hitting the Earth. And the question was, okay, well, why did the asteroid kill all the dinosaurs but not kill all the mammals? And there are some arguments that are raised. Mammals are warm-blooded, so they would be more resilient, maybe small, so they could burrow and hide, and that their big time came after and all that kind of thing. But there are problems with every single explanation that is given. Problems not because I say so, but because other evolutionists say, nah, that ain't working. There's no way that could be the case. And they'll say, this is this and this and this is why. And then you'll have those that say, well, your theory is wrong and it couldn't be that. And there are a lot of different things. There is one view that is seriously held, and I didn't read enough about it, but the view is basically dietary changes created constipation in the dinosaurs and led to basically widespread death, go through a disease type of thing, that had to do with changes of vegetation. That's why there is. And what they're trying to explain is why it is that there are so many basically dinosaur graveyards, why you find so often abundances of fossils in particular places. And in all of these scenarios, or most of the scenarios that are raised, the evolutionist basically says some great cataclysmic event happened which covered up the dinosaurs with water and sediment. And this is what has led to, and this is why they're congregated, this is why all these things happen. So the evidence, the physical evidence that they are ascribing to these calamitous events. And it's interesting how that evolutionists, when it helps them, they become catastrophists. I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with this, but one of the primary tenets of evolutionary theory, and this is especially emphasized in geology, is the doctrine of uniformitarianism. And that is that things come about through slow change. In other words, the reason why the Grand Canyon is as deep as it is because over millions and millions and millions and millions and millions of years, the trickle of water that is the Rio Grande River eventually cut into the rock and it led to that particular place. Now, the catastrophism, which would be the view that we would hold, and that is that much of what we see with regard to world geology, with regard to the extinction events, with regard to all of these things, can be better explained by a worldwide flood. Is the other view of things, which is roundly rejected because it is a supernatural explanation. So scientists have a problem with it. But with regard to the extinction of the dinosaurs, none of that uniformitarian doctrine fits, and so they call upon a catastrophe. And catastrophe explains extinction. And so the flood is a catastrophe would explain that to a very great extent as well, because there was worldwide extinction, and so the fossils that we see would be evidence of that. Now, why do we not have dinosaurs today? We do have some. We do have some reptiles, but there was most probably a very severe climate change that happened post-flood. That's again supposition, but that's one thing that scientists who take the creation viewpoint, young Earth viewpoint, they postulate. They try to indicate that maybe a decrease with regard to the age of man is in part because of climatary and physical changes to the Earth post-flood. Whether there's any legitimacy of that, I don't know. My view is God didn't want people to live as long anymore, and so they didn't live as long as a result of it. But regardless of that, there's another possibility as man himself, and I thought that was kind of an interesting thing when that was postulated. I'd like you to turn very quickly over to the Genesis account, chapter 9. Some of you may have jumped the gun. That's why I like to put it up one at a time, but I didn't take the time to do that this time. But in Genesis chapter 9, post-flood, I want you to notice what was said by God to Noah. Starting verse 1, God blessed Noah's son, said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth. And the fear of you and the dread of you shall be on every beast of the earth, on every bird of the air, on all that move on the earth, and on all the fish of the sea. They are given into your hand. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you, as I have given you all things, even as the green herbs. But you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is the blood." So here is that explanation concerning the fact that they could and should hunt, be carnivores, in other words, or omnivores, in other words, as a part of their existence, and given the approval of God by that. So it may be that they just were hunted to extinction. Man has certainly done that on many, many, many occasions, and this could be an example of that with regard to some of these. By the way, just as an aside, one of the things that that are considered absurd about this whole concept is the flood and the ark and dinosaurs on the ark. And I think that we ought to make some dinosaurs. You know, we've got those Noah ark models. And I don't know that I've seen any with we got the giraffes, we got the elephants. Maybe we ought to have a little brontosaurus on there as well. Just to kind of indicate the truth of that and get that in our children's minds. But I want you to recognize that you know, there are baby T-Rexes. And we're talking about kinds. I don't know how distinct the kinds are. Only God knows that. But with regard to dinosaurs, you didn't have to take full-grown ones. And the interesting thing is juvenile, which means children, with regard to dinosaurs were about the size of a large dog, you know, some of the bigger ones. So it's not something that would necessarily be precluded with regard to the ark either. So there are some explanations that can be given in that regard as well. So those are some possible explanations. Don't know what happened. All I know is there was a flood, and all I know is that today there are no big dinosaurs like there was and like we see there to be in the fossils in the ground. Okay? Don't know how it happened. But it's interesting that there is no unanimity. And this is kind of, and I'll show you this in I think not the next slide, but the one after. There's really no unanimity among evolutionists either with regard to how these kinds of things happen. There are theories, and there are some theories that gain popularity, but they have problems with them, and some say, no, it couldn't be that way. Same thing we talked about with regard to the Big Bang. Now, there are some people saying, you know, we've been thinking about Big Bang, and everybody agrees. Well, by the way, that's probably wrong. And, of course, when someone says that, then someone else comes along and says, now, wait a minute, who are you? Why are you telling us that? And they argue amongst themselves in that regard. So we don't know exactly what happened to them, but that's a possibility. Now I want to give you just a couple of evidences of man's coexistence. And these are, they are not direct evidences because there is no direct evidence. I don't have a photograph of a man with his arm around a dinosaur. Sorry, that doesn't exist. But there are some interesting things that happen. We're not going to look at all of them, but here are just a couple. Biblical references that we've already described would be one kind of indirect evidence. There is a relief at a Buddhist temple in Cambodia that was like 11. It was erected in the 1100s, There's just tons and tons of columns. And this is about this big around. So you've got these tons and tons of columns with all of these creatures, different kinds of animals and everything on all these columns. And one of them is what looks to be like a stegosaur. Of course, the stegosaur is one of the dinosaurs that we're most familiar with the plates on the back. So that's the picture of it in close up. There's another example that we might have. The Patasaurus, I think, is kind of isn't it the Brontosaurus, but big size. The Brontosaurus is kind of a subgenus of the Patasaurus or whatever you call it. So Patasaurus is the correct term these days instead of Brontosaurus. And this is actually in southeastern Utah, the Natural Bridges National Monument. There is Indians that inhabited that area between 500 and 1450 AD that drew pictures, pictographs on cave walls. And you'll notice I don't know if you can make it out, but here's the legs and arms of a man. And then here is an image, a drawing of what looks very much like an Apatosaurus or Brontosaurus. Now, understand this. When did we begin to get knowledge of what these animals look like? 1850s, mid-1850s. They were in the ground, covered up. And so these things weren't known as far as these kinds of... In other words, if you go back in the 1100s in Cambodia, 1100s, yeah, the 1100s in Cambodia, did individuals, had they excavated and put together a fossil of a stegosaurus, know what it looks like? And so these are kind of indications that possibly they had some familiarity with the animals. And there are bunches of these. There's an interesting one in Mexico, and I don't know if it's legitimate or not. There's some questions about it, but Don Patton, some of you may be familiar with Don Patton. He's a professor of geology. He was on that expedition recently that tried to go up on Ararat and find the Ark. And he met a man down in Mexico who had a collection of figurines. And there are a lot of dinosaur figurines, but the dating of them and the story that the man gave and the corroboration seems to be evident that these things are of ancient origin, not something he made himself or a hoax. They may be. I have to say that those kinds of things really bother me. There's another example that we might make note of, and I was going to bring that up, but I didn't have time to go into it researching the pictures. But there are... tracks in the Biloxi Riverbed in Glenrose of dinosaurs, and there seems to be tracks of human tracks that are crossing over the dinosaur tracks, which would be impossible unless they lived at the same time. And the reason why is because you have the dinosaur stepping in the mud, and then in the middle of the track, and actually it's not just one footprint, but it's a trail of human footprints that trail out. I think there are 40-something footprints, and one of them steps right in the impression made by the dinosaur footprint, and it goes on its way. And so you have basically the path of a human and a dinosaur crossing. Well, if you ask evolutionists about those tracks, two things happen. One is that they claim that it's a hoax, that it was carved. And they've done a cross-section of one of the tracks. They took the track out, they cut it with a saw, and they saw that the indentation was not carved, but rather there was a compression of the mud, which showed in the impression of the heel of the human who stepped in that footprint. And so it was naturally made. And so then they've got this rock, and they say, "See, look." And they say, "Well, where'd this come from? How do we know that this didn't come from somewhere else?" Or that, you know, in other words, it's not in situ. It's not there where it was. And the reason why it's not there is because they took it out in order to show it to them. But it's kind of a difficult thing. They don't want to believe it. Understand that. They just, why would you not look at this as evidence? Well, because men and dinosaurs didn't live at the same time. Well, if there's evidence, I show you evidence that they did, but they didn't. So that's not evidence. So you understand the problem with that, and we run into that problem quite often. So here's just a couple of examples. Let me give you another point to be made that you mentioned is the ubiquity and antiquity of the dragon legends. Again, I don't know if that's legitimate evidence, but it is somewhat compelling. One of the things that we talk about is the ubiquity of the flood stories throughout all the different cultures. And individuals will say, "Well, yeah, but you got yours, or the Bible got theirs from Babylonia." Well, you know, that's arguing as to whether that, you know, Babylonia came from the actual truth or whether, you know, back and forth. But the fact is, in just about every single culture, there are ancient legends concerning worldwide flood. And that's ubiquitous. And that seems to indicate that maybe there's a kernel of truth behind it. Well, the same thing is true with regard to dragons. I mean, you're talking about European cultures, the Greeks, you're talking about cultures, the Indians, you're talking about, of course, China, throughout all over the world. And this is a 1981 Science Digest article concerning the spread of the dragon myths. And it said, as myths, they're among the most persistent and widespread in the world. From millennium to millennium and over all the Earth's continents, dragon and serpent lore shows remarkable similarity. And then they say, of course, dragons don't exist. And okay, I'll say that too. Dragons don't exist. But look at what the dragon is supposed to be. A flying reptile. A large reptile. Is it possible that there is a kernel of truth behind the myths? And that is perhaps an indication as to the ubiquity of those things. And of course, the Bible uses the term. I don't know the creature it has reference to, and what that is, that is a certainty. But that's just something to indicate. And again, when you say, I mean, when you see that right there, dragons, of course, are myth. I want you to understand the pontification of those statements and those words. That they say that, and they also say that the world, of course, is not less than 4.5 billion years old. Or that, of course, man and dinosaurs didn't exist at the same time. And of course this, and of course that. Well, and we're not going to have time to do this. I want to talk about this next week. They have discovered some soft tissue in 98 million year old T-Rex fossils. Soft tissue, which is not possible. But then they say, okay, well, it was seemingly impossible. For years and years and years, they thought it was impossible until they actually found it. So is it possible then maybe the fossils aren't as old as what they think? Oh, no. They're 98 million years old, but we got to figure out why or how it could possibly be that there's still soft tissue in them. Because that fits their construct of age. And so they've come up with some examples of that. And we'll talk about this more in detail when we have an opportunity. But I want you to notice there's a title of an article that I came up with to look at this. And it says, controversial T-Rex soft tissue find is finally explained. And this is the statement made. The controversial discovery of 68 million-year-old soft tissue. I thought it was 98, but it's 68. Million-year-old soft tissue from the bones of a Tyrannosaurus rex finally has a physical explanation. According to new research, iron in the dinosaur's body preserved the tissue before it could decay. Doesn't that sound certain? But when you actually go into the article, it's not certain at all. This is an explanation they've come up with as being possible. And we got a minute. We got time, don't we? This is interesting. I mean, I'll have something else to talk about next time. But notice this: the scientist. She thinks that she has the answer. That's when you get farther down after that first couple of paragraphs in the article. She thinks that this might be it. Dinosaurs' iron-rich blood combined with a good environment for fossilization may explain the amazing existence of soft tissue from the Cretaceous period and even earlier. So it might explain it. So now we're not exactly sure. Well, how did they come up to the possibility that that might work? Because they say that the iron, it releases free radicals, it acts as formaldehyde, and this is what happens. Well, I want you to notice what the experiment was. They thought, well, let's look and see if iron could be preserved. So what they did was they got some, this is gross, but they got some modern ostrich blood vessels, and they put it in the vat, two different vats. In one, they poured water. In another, they poured a liquid made of red blood cells, and then they sat and waited. And within a few weeks, or a few days, the blood vessels and water disintegrated, became a disgusting mess. But after 2 years, in the iron-rich liquid, the red blood cells, they're still recognizable. There have been degradation, but they're still recognizable after 2 full years. Now, I'm just going to give you a parallel, and then we'll pick up this next time. I painted my house 8 years ago. And my paint lasted pretty well for about 8 years. And now it's starting to peel. So that paint lasted for 8 years. Since it lasted for 8 years and it's still looking pretty good on parts of my house, I'm gonna have to repaint. Because one side of the house is falling apart. Okay, 8 years, it's still looking pretty good. Can I postulate from 8 years that it's gonna still look pretty good in 68 million years? Are there going to be any paint left in 68? You understand the problem? And what I'm saying is that for them to make such, we figured out how it happened, this is what happened, and then they pull back, but it might have happened, so this is a possibility. When the single, and that's the only one that they've done so far, I mean, I'm sure they're in the process of trying to do other experiments and all, but we're talking about time, which, by the way, you can't wait 68 million years to see if that works. It's not going to work that way. But to extrapolate 2 years to 68 million and say this might be the exact, this may explain it. Instead of that, well, maybe actually that T-Rex hasn't been dead for 68 million years. Maybe it's been dead for 8,000 years or something like that. There's another possibility. No, that can't be. Of course, that's silly. That's ridiculous. It must be something different. And so that's kind of where we are with it. So, again, just in summary, the Bible may say something about dinosaurs, but the fact is that despite what you're fed, it is plausible that man and dinosaurs coexisted up until at least the time of the flood, and that there may have been an extinction shortly after, and that there are some evidences and all that we can look at to indicate the possibility of that. Okay? All right. That's all that I have for today. Appreciate it very much.